Hello, and welcome to the second episode of Dugout Blues, the Dodgers podcast. I am one of your hosts, Jared Massey. Your other host is...
Dustin Nosler.
And we are from LADugout.com and FeelingKindOfBlue.com, respectively. We want to thank everyone who listened to the first podcast previewing the Dodgers minor league and major league seasons, talking about the Dodgers sale. In this podcast, we are going to look back at the first four games of the major and minor league seasons, as well as a few free agent, or should I say, free agent affecting signings that have occurred over the past week. So right now, let's dive right into the 2012 season. The Dodgers won 3 out of 4 from San Diego. And who impressed you the most over the first series, Dustin?
It's pretty hard not to say Matt Kemp. You know, he picked up where he left off last season. Andre Ether, you know, he hasn't gotten a lot of hits, but he's gotten a bunch of extra base hits already, including a home run today against San Diego. But the guy who might have impressed the most is A.J. Ellis, who had himself quite a game last night.
Yeah, he's, you know, really shown that on-base percentage that we all knew he was capable of putting up. He's got 4 walks in 3 games. And that's about what I expect. I mean, I don't expect him to draw 200 walks this year, but I think that he's going to be a guy who he's so much different from Rob Barajas. Rob Barajas, low average, low walk rate, high power. Ellis is, you know, decent average, low power, high walk rate. And it's really going to be interesting kind of comparing and contrasting the type of production you get out of the catcher spot this year. Me personally, I would take Ellis's production over Barajas's because I put so much emphasis on on-base percentage where, you know, even if he's hitting 8th, he's going to be getting on base possibly close to 400% of, you know, 40% of the time, posting that near 400 on-base percentage. And he could do that only hitting 250, which I think is still very valuable. I don't place a lot of emphasis on batting average. For me, the guy who impressed me the most was Chad Billingsley. Coming out after a poor spring, lowered expectations. You know, he's the number 2 in rotation. Hiroki Kuroda's gone. He really needs to step up, and all of a sudden he becomes Superman out there. You know, nearly pitching a complete game shutout, striking out 11 guys. I was just thrilled. What did you think of his start?
It might have been the best he's ever pitched in a game. You know, I looked at the pitch FX after the game, and Brooks Baseball said he threw 48 cutters, and they're using an algorithm from game day. So I think that's totally inaccurate. I don't think he threw more than a handful of cutters that night. And it showed because his slider was on. It's the first time I've seen his slider in quite a while, and it was breaking pretty well. And his curveball was good, and, you know, the thing, I wrote a post about him a few weeks ago saying that he just needs to trust his fastball a little more, and lo and behold, he threw his fastball, clocked it in the low 90s most of the time, saw it as high as 94, and he had a lot of success. You know, if he just sticks to the basics, I think he's going to be all right.
Yeah, I think when he runs into problems, he's trying to be too fine. He's trying to be too precise. He's trying to hit that, you know, micro fraction of an inch of the black. And I think when he pitches more aggressively, when he's really confident in his pitches, specifically his fastball, I think that's what makes him a really competent pitcher. You know, he only walked one guy in his start, which is excellent. He only gave up 3 hits. So I think, and like you said, you know, Brooks Baseball had his cutter rate up due to pitch FX, but I looked at the game day, and you know, I think it was just miscasting his fastball for cutters. I don't think they have it completely figured out yet, because
his fastball and his slider, I mean, he was obviously throwing, I mean, you know, I'm not a scout or anything. I could just tell it was a slider, not his cutter, just because I've seen his cutter the last 3 years when he's been throwing it, you know, 15% to 25% of his pitches, and that was not his cutter the other night.
Yeah, and, you know, that's where the old adage that you got to trust your eyes come into play, because as much as I love statistics, they don't show you everything and they can mislead you. So, just watching the highlights, I actually didn't see the game, but watching the highlights of his performance, he just looked fantastic. That's the guy they really needed.
He was in control the entire game. I don't think I've ever seen him be that much in control of the game, even in the games that he's, pitched. I think he threw a shutout either last year or the year before against the Giants in Dodger Stadium, and he was in control of this game on Friday night against the Padres like I've never seen him pitch before.
Yeah, and we can only hope that he maintains that level of confidence, because the Dodgers desperately need him to step up with Kuroda gone, with Lilly working through an injury, and with Clayton Kershaw trying to go out there like Michael Jordan and play through the flu. I was panicking on Thursday. I was at a bar with some friends, and he throws his first pitch, and it's 86. I'm like, oh, he's starting off with a changeup, and then he throws another one at 86. I'm saying, that's not his changeup. And I was panicking. I was sure it was a shoulder or an elbow or something that was going horribly, horribly wrong. And thank God for Twitter. I log on, and Ken Gernick is there with the happy news, I guess you can call it, that, no, he's just got the flu, and apparently Mattingly found him passed out in the hallway to the clubhouse or something. I heard something like that. But, mm-hmm. gutsy performance from him, and the fact that he could have any amount of success throwing in the mid to high 80s just goes to show what kind of competitor he is.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's what an ace does. That's what he is going to do for the rest of his career. He went out, even though he didn't pitch five innings or he didn't go seven or what have you, he still got three scoreless innings. That fastball he struck out, I believe it was Headley on the inside fastball that ended that bases loaded jam. That just shows you he's going to be just fine. He's got to get over the flu bug.
Yeah, and I was really, really impressed with Josh Lindblom coming in and pitching two really, really strong innings. He did so today as well on Sunday in the loss, but he's been a big surprise for me early as well. One of the goats, I guess you can call him, is Todd Coffey, who came in today and really struggled. And of course, Albert giving up the grand slam to Headley. That was just a bad breaking ball, broke right into his happy zone. And all of this after Aaron Harang was getting harangued out there on the mound.
Yeah, when we talked last week, I forgot to mention him as a guy who kind of impressed me during spring, but he just didn't have it today. I noticed he's throwing his changeup a lot, and a lot right-handed hitters, and it doesn't do the same thing to righties as it does to lefties. It just kind of floats in there, and I'm not saying that it got hit around a lot today, but I think he needs to back away from throwing the changeup so much, especially to right-handers, and trust his fastball-slider combination.
You're talking about Albert?
No, Harang.
Oh, you're talking about Harang. When I saw him in spring training, he was decently locating his sinker. He was throwing the breaking ball a little inconsistently. I did see some change-ups, and it looks like he's trying to work on the pitch, and I guess if you're going to work on something, it might as well be in the first few weeks of the season. But at the same time, you have to realize when to cut bait and just go back to what's working for you. So hopefully he figures things out. And then of course on Saturday we had the Chris Capuano implosion. That was a really tough game to watch until the very
it's
end.
So weird it was. It was Billingsley-esque. He was cruising through four innings, and then all of a sudden the fifth inning came around, and he just totally lost it.
Yeah, I don't know what was wrong. If his mechanics were off, if it got to him mentally, whatever happened, I mean, it was just a mess to watch. It was not pleasant. And You know, the bullpen did a fine job of keeping the team in it, and D. Gordon had the game of his life. Just an unbelievable showing from the 23-year-old. Getting on base five times, stealing a pair of bases, making great highlight reel defensive plays. You know, that's what I want to see from him. And he walked twice, which was also really important for me. You know, he's needed to improve his plate discipline, and that's going to be something going forward that the fans should watch for, just making sure that he's getting on base at the top of the order.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you wanted to see D. Gordon at his best, what the pinnacle of his career could be is a game like that. I mean, that's everything you want from him, and even a little more with the walks. And then he also had the three stolen bases. It's just that's the prototypical game that we should hopefully be getting from D. Gordon, you know, consistently in the next 4 or 5 years.
I'm really hoping that he continues to develop, because when you look at the fact that he only started playing organized ball about 5 or 6 years ago, you know, he only started mm-hmm. playing baseball full time his senior year of high school. You know, it's just an amazing learning curve that he's picked up like it's nothing, and you can see that raw athleticism in his game that allows him to continue to grow. You know, he has the work ethic and appears to have the smarts to really advance from a freak athlete, because let's face it, he's one of the best athletes in the league. I think that's what's really allowing him to have a lot of success, you know, from the low minors to the high minors to the majors, is the simple fact that he's just such a gifted athletic specimen. Now it's the time to really learn from his mistakes, refine those rough edges in his game to really realize his potential, and this season will be key in his development, specifically, you know, getting on base, cleaning up his defense a little bit, and, you know, really just getting those tiny little nuances of the game going.
Yeah, he made an error today on Sunday against the Padres. It was a routine grounder. He just bobbled it and couldn't throw the guy out in time. You know, those are going to happen. You know, it's his first full season. I'm not too concerned about it. He's going to make those highlight reel plays like he did on opening night. So, you know, you got to give and get, give. You got to give a little give and take, you know?
Yeah. You have to expect some of those, you know, bonehead plays. You know, we saw that with Matt Kemp when he was coming up as a raw athlete, still learning how to play the game. But I think, you know, I would compare Gordon to Kemp, not in terms of what they'll produce on the field, but in terms of having the athleticism to overcome their shortcomings, to really realize their potential. You know, they have this incredible gift to, you know, make contact and read the ball on defense, and it's just going to take a little bit of time for them to, you know, do the little things right that makes them, you know, really complete players.
Yeah, definitely. I agree 100%.
So, Dodgers 3-1 starting the season. They have an off day on Monday, and then they head home for the home opener. Hopefully Kershaw is going to pitch. Hopefully the 4-ish days of rest will be enough, and then they take on Pittsburgh, who beat Philadelphia today on Easter. That was kind of a surprise to me. I want to see the same type of offense against better pitching. You know, Pittsburgh doesn't have great pitching. San Diego has a great ballpark, but not necessarily great pitching. And while people can look at the fact and that the Dodgers scored a bunch of runs, they scored, you know, how many runs this, you know, 23 runs this series against the Padres, or 21, they can, you know, get ahead of themselves and say, oh, well, you know, the Dodgers are going to do this or do that this season. I'm really looking forward to, you know, the series, you know, this month against maybe Milwaukee or Atlanta to really show that they can take on a good pitching staff and that the pitching staff can take on a good offense. So, you know, I'm not too much into making predictions, but the Dodgers have a pretty easy schedule this month and could end up with a very, very good April record. But, you know, getting it against poor quality teams, I'm not a big believer in just looking at the record out of context. I want to wait until they start getting into the division rivals. Like in May, they play San Francisco, they play Arizona, they play St. Louis. So regardless of what happens in April, I'm really more interested in seeing how they do against quality competition.
Yeah, definitely. That's going to be the measure of, are they a legitimate contender with what they have right now, or are they going to have to go out and make a move to become that legitimate contender? You know, I wrote a post last week saying, you know, I put it out there, and I'm not the only one to do this. I said the Dodgers are going to make the playoffs, and it's going to depend on making an acquisition before the trade deadline, a big bat, preferably. You know, if they can just hang around for a bit, you know, until July, if they're within striking distance of a playoff spot, with the new ownership going to be in place by then for sure, then they can, you know, make a move for that big bet, and, you know, time will tell who's available too. I noted David Wright and Paul Konerko as two potential targets. We'll see if those guys are even going to be available at that time. So, and, you know, somebody else might become available later on in the season.
Yeah, Konerko and Wright would be, you know, really, really interesting guys. James Loney's gotten off to a rough start this season. And, you know, I was hoping that he would really kind of roll off of last year's second half progress, but he just hasn't put it together just yet. I'm willing to give him a few months. I'm willing to give him until June, see if he can figure things out. You know, if he gets to June and he's still not hitting, then I do think you look for a replacement.
And yeah, his swing just looks all out of whack right now. He had a 2-1 fastball today right down the middle, and his swing looked so lethargic, he just rolled over on it to second base. I don't know what the deal is, but he's just not hitting the ball with any authority right now.
Yeah.
And that's not really any different than some of the struggles he's had in the past. And, you know, nobody's expecting him to be a 20-25 home run guy. But he's got to start hitting the ball a little better, you know, with some authority, like he did the last couple months of the season.
Absolutely. And I've noticed that he's more upright in his swing again. And when I was watching him in the second half of 2011, what I noticed was he was crouched more. And it really allowed him to take advantage of his considerable lower half, really torque his hips, and drive the ball. And for whatever reason, it just seems as though, you know, progressing slowly through spring training and now into the regular season, he's gotten more upright in his stance. And I think that really saps his power. I think he really needs to focus on you know, getting a more solid base and, you know, not arm swinging, which he has a tendency to do, which results in many a rollover to the middle infield instead of really driving the ball with authority. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that Dave Hansen can work with him on that to get him back to where he was last August, last September, because they need that cog in the offense. You know, Kemp is off to a great start, Ethier's off to a great start, but they need someone else, specifically someone hitting in the middle of the lineup, be it Rivera, be it Uribe, although I say that, you know, the massive
good luck.
Yeah.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, but they do need someone to come out and hit well, you know, besides the two stars in the lineup. And I was hoping that Loney would be that guy this year. And, you know, I know it's a really, really short, small sample, but he just hasn't looked like Loney from the second half of last year, and hopefully Hansen can work with him and get him right.
Now, is that on Hanson to notice that and coach him up on that and say, hey, you got to get back to doing this, that, and the other? Or is it also on Loney for not having whatever you want to call it, mental toughness or the awareness that he's doing things, he's going back to what didn't work for him, you know, maybe subconsciously? Is it up to him to realize what he's doing?
For me, it's both, and it's more on the player. You know, the player, we are talking about professional athletes, you know, not Rhodes Scholars, but I think when you see what you're doing is not working, you have to be aggressive about changing it. You have to be the type of person who says, I can admit when I'm wrong, I can admit when something's not working, and I'm going to do whatever I can to make it work. And with Loney, you know, what he's been doing hasn't been working. Second half of last year, he found something different. He found something maybe from his past. Maybe he went back to doing something he did when he was younger, and it started working. And he had a great amount of success in the, you know, in 2 months. But I think it's up to the player, and I would say that the coach is there to instruct and not to inform. But with some coaches, yeah, I could see guys who would, you know, call him up and say, okay, you need to come to the film room. We need to look at your swing. You know, go get some balls and let's head to the tee. Let's head to the batting cages. I think it's really up to the player to make that decision to say something needs to change. I need to work on this, and I need to fix it. I think the impetus is on Loney, but I wouldn't be opposed to Hanson saying, hey, your swing is messed up. We need to work on your swing. Get in the cage. So I know I'm not really answering your question, but
No, it's fine. I mean, I'm kind of in the same place. It's on both.
Yeah.
And I agree it's more on the player because, like you said, they're professionals. This is what they get paid to do. They should realize when they're doing something that's making them unsuccessful. And, you know, it'd be different if this was James Loney for his entire career. But he had that great first season. He had that great 2 months last season. You know, it's there. It's obviously there. He just has not found whatever it is he needs to find for it to be consistently good.
Yeah, and unfortunately, if he doesn't find it by June or July, he could be on his way out. He could be on his way to, I wouldn't send him down, but maybe a bench role, a platoon role. And, you know, I'd hate to give up on him, him being, the first-round pick in 2002. But, yeah, I mean, the bottom line is if he's not producing, then they need to go out and find someone who is producing. And speaking of which, you brought up a few names in our last podcast who might be available at the trade deadline who are no longer available. Joey Votto signed a massive extension with the Cincinnati Reds. So, you know, scratch one name off your list for possible deadline fodder. And then the Giants locked up Matt Cain for 5 years. Give me your impressions on what those signings mean to the Dodgers' prospects of adding a bat or an arm at the deadline.
Well, to get a Joey Votto, they wouldn't have to mortgage the farm, but they'd have to trade probably 5 prospects of somewhere in the top 15 to even get in the ballpark with Votto, because he was signed through next season as well at a pretty affordable rate. Votto, everybody was saying Votto was going to be a Dodger after 2013 because they're going to have the money to sign him. Obviously, that's not going to happen because Cincinnati said, okay, we want to build around this guy. Obviously, we're going to give him Alex Rodriguez money, which, you know, that can be debated whether that was a good move or a bad move. Then for Matt Cain, you know, there were going to be 3 really big name free agent pitchers after this season: Cole Hamels, Zach Greinke, and Matt Cain. And, you know, with the Dodgers' current pitching situation, they could have been in the market for 1 or 2 of them. And now that Cain's gone, obviously, they could still go after either Hamels or Greinke next season. But we'll talk about that when we get to it. As for Kane staying with the Giants, you know, it's my prerogative to hate the Giants, you know, Dodger fan my whole life. But if there's anybody on that team right now who I'd want on the Dodgers, it would have been Matt Kane. The guy is just a really good pitcher. I don't know if he's highest paid right-handed pitcher of all time money, highest paid pitcher of all time good, but he's pretty damn good. You know, they weren't going to trade for him, obviously. The Giants and Dodgers would never make a trade that big, no matter who's in first, who's in last, what have you. You know, they're probably not going to be in the market for a starting pitcher this trade deadline anyway, so that would have had to wait till after the season.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I think if they're going to add an arm, it's going to be after the season. Hamels seems like a perfect fit. Pairing him with Kershaw, you know, you add Billingsley, and then you add one of the Dodgers' young prospects, maybe a Zach Lee or a Nathan Eovaldi, Alan Webster, and that would just give them a tremendous rotation going forward. But like you said, I think that's something that they would wait for after the season. As far as Votto, I also agree that he would have cost an arm and a leg and a bat and another bat and another arm. But he, I have to take exception with how much money they gave him. I mean, that's just an absurd amount of money for a first baseman, for a guy who was under control for a few more, you know, for through 2013. It's just so much money. It's, you know, $225 million, and then you got the $20 million club option. That's just absurd amounts of cash. He's a very good player. I'm not going to take anything away from him. He's a very good first baseman. Do you want to give,
you know, 2010 NL MVP? Good, you know?
Exactly. But on the, you know, other side of the coin, do you really want to give that type of money to one player, especially who you had cheap? I just can't wrap my head around that. You know, I see him being a you know, upper echelon first baseman. You know, he's a career 313 hitter. He hits for power. He gets on base, which is nice. But, you know, in that ballpark with their organizational needs going forward, specifically pitching, to dedicate that much in resources to one player, I just got to question that. And I think they would have been better off dealing him in the offseason to the dismay of their fan base, but, you know, getting just a lot of good or great young prospects in return would have really set them apart and really set them up to, you know, be contenders in the NL Central for years to come. I just don't see the reasoning behind the decision being that sound. But, you know, I'm not a major league GM. Walt Jocketty is, so who am I to argue?
you know, it comes down to, you know, there's a lot of things that factor into it. One, they want to have that face of the franchise to build around for the next decade. They're going to probably, you know, keep ticket sales or possibly increase ticket sales with this move. You know, they're not trying to shed the cliche of a small market team, but they are not exactly, you know, the Red Sox or the Yankees. Mm-hmm. They went out and paid Red Sox Yankee money to Joey Votto to keep him in town. For that, you know, they probably would have to pay him more for him to stay right now than risk losing him or having to trade him either this July or next July. You know, it's just the price you got to pay. It's kind of like what happens with the Dodger sale. They went, you know, behind closed doors and had to offer probably a little bit more than maybe the other bidders were willing to go to make sure that the deal happened. That's kind of what I liken it to in this case.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I agree that in order to get what you need, sometimes you do need to overpay. And you'll hear a lot of people, like me, saying, oh, no, they shouldn't have given him 10 years. They should have given him 7. Well, what if 7 wasn't an option? What if he didn't want 7? What if he wanted 10? Mm-hmm. You know, what if he didn't want anything below $25 million a year? So while we can play the guessing game on that front and, you know, just speculate that, oh, well, they should have given him this, they should have given him that, we weren't in the room. We didn't know what was going on. That said, he's 28. You know, he's likely going to be out of his prime in 5 years. Personally, I like him. You know, I have nothing against Canadians. And hopefully he will do well for them. I mean, they're a franchise that's had a lot of trouble really getting going, you know, especially after the Ken Griffey Jr. debacle. You know, one of my favorite players growing up, he goes and signs a massive deal and just can't stay healthy. I wish him the best of luck, and I wish the organization the best of luck, except when they're playing the Dodgers. But, yeah, I think we'll just have to wait and see what happens, you know, in year 6, year 7 of the deal. So those are...
I mean, it's going to... You know, it's going to be like the Pujols deal. He's not going to be worth that much money in year 6, in year 7, in year 8, most likely. They're paying him for what he's done already and what he's going to do in the next 4 or 5 years.
Yeah,
and they're also, you know, they're in contention right now, too. They have a chance to take the Central. Pujols is gone. Prince Fielder is gone from Milwaukee. There's, you know, the division's not exactly open and shut. They can still go for that division title and make the playoffs. They were a playoff team just 2 years ago.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, the Matt Latos acquisition, I was a big fan of that for them.
I was too.
Getting him at the top of the rotation with Cueto, a very, very good move. You look at the rest of their rotation now, you know, they have Bronson Arroyo as their third starter. I'm sorry, but at this point, he should be a mop-up guy. you know, they have glaring holes. Brandon Phillips' contract is you know, coming to an end soon. So I just would have thought that they would have been better off going the trade route, getting, you know, a lot of other needs filled. But we'll see what happens, you know. And, you know, this is a Dodger podcast. The reason we're talking about this is because we're talking about potential Dodgers and formerly potential Dodgers. The Dodgers still will have some options this year at the trade deadline, this offseason, next offseason, to add another big bat. Votto's out of the equation. There are still some guys who could be had at the trade deadline, but we'll get more into that closer to July 31st. So changing gears from the major leagues to the minor leagues, as many of you know, the major league season opened way back in March in Japan to fanfare, any fanfare really. You know, it's hard to watch a game that's on at 3 a.m. And then there was the Cardinals game that was on Wednesday, but Thursday was opening day for the majority of the major leagues, and it was also opening day for the minor leagues as well. So looking back at the first few games of the minor league season, who stood out to you, Dustin, over the first 3 or 4 games for the Dodgers?
Yeah, we'll start in, I guess we'll start in Albuquerque. Maybe we can go in order like that.
Sure.
Scott Van Slyke has homered already 3 times this season for Albuquerque. You know, he's an older prospect, but he might be a late bloomer. And obviously hitting in the PCL is going to inflate his numbers a little bit. But he might, you know, be making some noise here in a couple months. If, like you were talking about Loney earlier, who might not pan out, maybe Van Slyke can be that guy to step in. You know, he might even jump ahead of Jerry Sands, who's off to a slow start, although he did hit a home run today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Van Slyke kind of, you know, just really jumps out at you right away with his power potential in Albuquerque. And also, Tim Fedorovich actually is hitting the ball. I was not a fan of the deal last July. You know, he's a good defensive catcher, but I don't see him as much more than a backup type. But whatever, we can talk about that later. He's actually hitting the ball a little bit. He actually hit a home run, too. So those two guys for Albuquerque right now kind of got off to a hot start, and they're looking pretty solid so far.
Yeah, Vance, like, he's 25 years old. Not a great age for a prospect. Had a breakout season. I guess you could call 2010 a breakout season, although he did in the California League, and then he couldn't hit double-A pitching. 2011, he starts hitting double-A pitching, but he's already 24. Now he's 25, and he's crushing in triple-A. So while he could be that late bloomer power prospect that the Dodgers desperately need, there is a lot of 4A player in him, and by 4A player, I mean he's too good for triple-A, but not good enough for the majors. He fell a triple short of the cycle today, by the way, and he's hitting 500, three home runs, just doing a tremendous job of making his case to be on the big league club. He had a decent spring as well. Fedorovich is hitting 438 with four hits today. Like you said, I was not a huge fan of the trade. I didn't think that he would be, I didn't think he was an appropriate centerpiece for that trade. We'll see what happens with him, because he hit really, really well after he came over last year when he was in Albuquerque, and then he went up to the big club and got sparse at bats, didn't really do well. He's a guy who needs to be in the lineup every day to really get adjusted. But as long as AJ Ellis is hitting, then I really don't see the point in bringing Fedorovich up, because he'd probably just be languishing on the on the bench. Another guy who's interesting to me is Alex Castellanos, who we've talked about in last week's podcast. He actually played right field today and tripled. He has been playing second base. The Dodgers are trying to move him back to the infield, which he played a few years back. If he can stick at second base, I'm a huge fan. He made a pretty brutal error the other day that led to the team's loss, but he's another guy to watch. Specifically, if he can get it going on defense at second. And he's another guy who, like D. Gordon, needs to show that he can draw a walk, because that's been one of his bugaboos moving up through the minors. So anyone else on AAA worth talking about?
Sure there is, but I don't recall off the top of my head. Josh Fields is hitting the ball a little bit, just with Juan Uribe. God, it just pains me to say that name.
Shiver up your spine, though.
Sends something up my something. sends my lunch up my throat, I guess.
There you go.
It's just, the fact that Josh Fields even might have a chance to play some third base for the Dodgers this year is really saying everything you need to know about their the third base position for the Dodgers right now.
But they have Adam Kennedy, too.
Oh, God. right now, I honestly think a trio of Kennedy, Hairston, and Justin Sellers would be better than Juan Uribe.
Oh, poor little Juan.
Yeah.
Has there ever
little
been
about
such,
that guy.
Yeah, has there ever been such a despised figure in L.A.?
Well, in L.A., I'm sure, but as far as Dodgers players, he might be my most despised of them all.
Yeah, only...
Even more than Andrew Jones, even more than Jason Schmidt, I cannot stand the guy. I do not like his game at all. He's overpaid. He's a former Giant, so on and so forth.
He's got many, many strikes against him. So, moving on to AA, we saw the season debuts of guys like Alan Webster, who is a top prospect. He actually struggled in his first start. He got a case of the walkies and just could not throw strikes. Guy who debuted today, Matt McGill, is not much of a top prospect, but he went five innings and allowed no hits and no runs. He's one of those kind of crafty righties that is just... loathed in the scouting community, doesn't throw that hard, mixes speeds, though, he throws strikes. where did you have him coming into the season? Did you have him ranked?
Yeah, I think I had him last season. I think I had him in the top 15. Mm. A little bit ambitious on that, I think. I had him at number 45 this year. Just because he didn't pitch particularly well in the Cal League. You know, I was impressed with his start today, though. Yeah. 5 no-hit innings, only two walks and 6 strikeouts in Double-A. That's, you know, that's not something to just overlook. And he's, if I recall correctly, he's a little young, maybe, or right on age par for the league. I think he's 22, right?
Yeah, he is 22. And actually a local boy for me, at least. He was born about 10, 15 minutes away from where I live in Simi Valley, California. Yeah, so he had a decent year last year in the Cal League, put up an ERA of about 4.3. He gets strikeouts, oddly enough, and I think it's because he does mix his pitches well. He throws a decent amount of strikes. And, you know, to say a guy didn't pitch well in the California League isn't really a knock against him. You know, rarely do you find guys who pitch well in the California League.
Right. I mean, Alan Webster pitched pretty well in the Cal League before he got promoted, but then comparing Webster to McGill is apples and oranges in terms of prospect status.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point, because Webster is, you know, one of the top prospects in the system, mostly because of the fact that he has a much better fastball. But, yeah, McGill's a guy to watch. Another guy to watch who had an interesting debut was Ethan Martin, who is back in the rotation after finishing last year in Chattanooga's pen. He goes out and pitches 4 2/3 shutout innings, but he also walked 4 batters and allowed 3 hits. He's a guy who, you know, he was the 2008 first-round pick. He's a guy with a, you know, really good fastball-curveball combination, but, you know, has always had problems throwing strikes. And he was cruising through the first few innings of his start and then just really ran into a lot of trouble in innings 4 and 5 and ended up having to leave before he was even eligible for a decision. He's a guy who, at least one person has told me, should break out this year. But, you know, if he's walking almost a batter an inning, then I don't see that happening.
Yeah, you know, I've kind of lost the hope in Martin. Mm-hmm. If you can't throw strikes, I don't care how good your stuff is, you're not going to be successful if you can't get the ball to the plate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the encouraging part, 6 strikeouts in 4 2/3. Mm-hmm. The discouraging part, 7 base runners in 4 2/3. You know, that's always going to be the thing for him. And, you know, unless he gets that control figured out to where it's even close to average, he's probably going to end up in the bullpen, and if he ends up in the bullpen, he's still going to have to find that control, or at least more control, you know, enough control to be a reliever.
Yeah, I mean, you can't be in the bullpen walking guys left and right. That just really drives managers insane. But he has the stuff. That's what's so frustrating, you know. And another guy like Chris Withrow, former first-round picks, they have the stuff to succeed. They just need to harness it, and he's someone who really just needs to harness his stuff. Another debut was from Aaron Miller, the 2009 first-round draft pick. He went only 2 2/3 innings, allowing 5 hits, but only 1 run, and he struck out 3. He was getting his pitch count up, and I haven't heard anything about an injury, but it just seems like they wanted to make sure that he didn't work too hard and would be, you know, available for his next start.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you heard anything, if he's on a strict pitch count. I think he was in the upper 50s before he came out, so maybe it was like 60, 65 or something like that.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if he was, because he's been dealing with injuries for the past, you know, few years. He was at, I think, about 57 pitches when he came out, and he's a guy who, you know, he's got pretty decent stuff, might profile better as a reliever at this point in his career, especially if he struggles with staying healthy. But, you know, the Dodgers are going to give him every opportunity to start. and hopefully he'll take advantage of it. Hopefully he'll just, you know, stay in one piece. On the hitting side, Kyle Russell, who's back in Double A for whatever reason, has already struck out 5 times in 4 games, so that's to be expected. JT Wise is 4 for his first 10 with a home run. He's another old guy. He's going to be 26 this year. It looks like Griff Erickson is not starting, which is part of the organization's problems. They have kind of a logjam with catchers going up the upper levels of the system. They have Tim Fedorovich entrenched in AAA, and then in AA you have to kind of split time between Erickson and Wise. So,
well, I don't know why you have to. I mean, Erickson's clearly the better prospect. Wise is going to give your team a better chance to win, and of course it's on the manager down there. But I saw Wise was also playing a little bit of first base. Doesn't look like they have much in the way of first base other than Brian Cavazos Galvez. He played a little first base last year. And they also have Matt Wallach there, too, who I don't know why he's getting as much playing time as he's getting right now.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I would be giving the vast majority of plate appearances to Erickson, and I would basically let Wallach back up or spot start and put Wise at first. I don't know why Cavazos Galvez is getting so much playing time. He really hasn't hit much since 2010. He went up to AA last year and really struggled. Not a lot of offense out of this group. Jake Lemmerman, your boy. He's hit a little bit to start the season. 3 for his first 10. He might be a guy to watch if he can, you know, just make contact, get on base. You know, Profiles is, in my view, is more of a utility guy, but could be an interesting bench option for the Dodgers moving forward.
My other guy down there, Blake Smith, he's off to a bit of a rough start, 1 for 13 with 2 walks and 5 strikeouts. So hopefully he gets it turned around here pretty quick.
Yeah, I think he will. You know, I love his swing. I really do. And if he just stays balanced through it, then I think he'll have a fair amount of success. Moving down to Rancho Cucamonga, we've got the pitching staff of the century. And for me, the best single performance of any minor leaguer to start the season was that of Zach Lee on opening night. Goes 5 innings, allows 1 hit, 1 walk, no runs, and strikes out 5. I was very, very impressed that he could come out and be just absolutely dominant in his first start in the California League.
Yeah, that was pretty impressive. You know, the question was going to be for him was going to be moving up from the Midwest League, a really good pitchers league, to the Cal League, a really good hitters league, see how he was going to handle it. And so far, so good. It's one game, but, you know, he's on the right track. Like I said earlier, Alan Webster pitched really well with the Quakes last season before getting called up to AA. So it's not totally unheard of for high-level pitching prospects to pitch well in the Cal League.
Yeah, and they had a pitching prospect out there named Lily today who got lit up. Oh, wait, that's the Dodgers' number 3 starter.
And did you see who hit a grand slam off of him?
I did not. Who was it?
CJ Cron.
Oh, our buddy from last year's draft.
Yeah. So, you know, just saying.
Just saying. Not saying too much, but just enough. Garrett Gould and Chris Reed, who are 2 of the Dodgers' top pitching prospects, each had decent debuts. They both gave up 3 runs in 5 innings for a 5.4 ERA. However, both struck out more batters than innings pitched, I guess you can say. Gould racked up 7 strikeouts in 5 innings, while Reed punched out half a dozen. Those two guys are going to be interesting to watch to see if they can really stretch themselves out this season. I think Gould, when I saw him in Arizona, he was, you know, not throwing as hard as I expected, and I was wondering if he might have been. I don't want to speculate too much, but I was hoping that he's just basically going. He was going at 90%. With Reed, I'm really, really interested to see how he does in his first full season of starting, because he hasn't had a lot of work, especially for a guy coming out of college. He was in the bullpen for so long, but he's definitely a guy, another guy who's going to be monitored very closely by the organization this season.
Yeah, Gould's pretty much only blemish from that game was a three-run home run by a guy named Jet Bandy. Sounds pretty made up to me, but whatever. That's the only runs he gave up was a three-run homer. So, other than that, and you can't discount that, but he pitched pretty well besides that three-run homer.
Well, I actually think his name is Jeff Bandy, and I believe he went to the same high school I did.
So I'm ripping on one of your boys.
You are ripping on one of my boys, and I'm going to step up and throw down the gauntlet or whatever. he went to and he was actually drafted by the Dodgers out of high school, Thousand Oaks High School. Anyone? Okay. So, yeah.
Just for the record, I'm looking at Inland Empire's roster on their official website. It says Jet, J-E-T-T.
Well, I believe that is an error, an input error. I believe his first name is Jeff. If I'm wrong, if the Jeff or Jet Bandy fan club would like to have their voices heard on Dugout Blues, please tell us that we are mispronouncing his name. I'm looking, I'm seeing Jeff on the Google, and Google doesn't lie. So we'll agree to disagree on however you say his name, on Mr. Bandy, the Honorable Mr. Bandy. On the hitting side, Chris O'Brien, who was the surprise promoter or promotee to High A year after being drafted, has gotten off to a pretty quick start. He's 6 for 16, although he hasn't had any extra base hits or walks, so his line is 375, 375, 375.
Pretty consistent.
Yeah, very consistent. Austin Gallagher has a similarly similar line, 313, 389, 375. Leon Landry, who really, really struggled last year, hit a home run today and has already stolen a pair of bases. Nick Akins has homered. Anyone else on the offense that you're looking forward to watching this season?
No, you've already touched on a couple, and let me just say something about one of my former favorite prospects, Tony Delmonico, who hit a triple. He had, I think it was a two-run triple last night. Uh-huh. But my favorite offensive player down there is Leon Landry. Uh-huh. I think he's primed to have a bounce-back season. And can you tell me why he's playing left field and Cassio Grider's playing center field over him?
I cannot. I honestly don't know what that's about. Grider was the second baseman for the Loons last year. He has great speed. I can tell you that much. And I am under the impression that the Dodgers are just trying something new. Landry has a bad arm. He does not have a strong throwing arm. Perhaps they're thinking he's better suited in left field. Even though I thought he was a pretty good defensive center fielder,
I think he's their best defensive center fielder for sure, and possibly best defensive outfielder minus the whole arm thing. I mean, it's not like we're dealing with another Juan Pierre out there.
I hope not. But his move to left field is very similar to that of Pierre.
But what I was saying is, Landry knows how to go track down a ball where Pierre doesn't.
That's a fair point. I think that the Dodgers are just trying something new. They're just trying to get Grider a little bit of experience in center field because Landry has good speed. Grider has very good speed. Grider is faster. So those two will probably be covering a lot of ground this season for the Quakes. Moving down even further in the full season bracket to Great Lakes, We saw a few interesting pitching performances this spring. Jarrett Martin, who I actually was following in the 09 draft. I wanted the Dodgers to draft him. They ended up passing on him, and then he went to junior college, where he was drafted by the Baltimore Orioles. And lo and behold, this offseason, Dana Evelyn goes to Baltimore, and Martin comes back along with another player
Tyler
to the
Hansen.
Dodgers. Tyler Hansen, thank you very much. And, you know, when I was watching him in high school, he had such a clean arm action. And when I'm watching him now, he's all over the place, and he's wild and kind of knees and elbows. And I was really hoping that the Dodgers would fix him up. I mean, I know it's early, but, you know, he's a lefty. He can get up to 95, decent breaking ball. You know, he's definitely one to watch for me. Who else looks good on the pitching staff to you, Dustin?
Yeah, I kind of like Martin more. He's probably ended up in the bullpen, honestly. But, you know, he gave up two hits and walked three, and he did hit a batter. But he also struck out six in those five innings. The biggest problem was he made three errors, which led to the two runs he gave up, which
yeah.
were ultimately unearned. But, yeah, you know, there's always a place for a lefty who can hit 95 with a decent breaking ball.
Yeah. Other players I was looking at, Yimi Garcia, who had a good year for Ogden last season. He's made his debut, two innings, three strikeouts, no runs. Two guys I noticed in spring training, Jose Dominguez and Ryan O'Sullivan, have both lost this season, so I put the whammy on them, apparently. Both of those guys are exciting arms to follow. Both can get their fastballs in the mid-90s. Dominguez showed me just a nasty, filthy breaking ball during one game. I saw him down there, and O'Sullivan, you know, he had an injury his junior season. I can't remember, or sophomore season. I can't remember exactly what it was, but he's a guy who I don't know if they're going to use him out of the bullpen just to build innings or if he's going to get some spot starts. He's a guy I'd like to see them develop as a starter. I think he has the repertoire for it, but we'll see what happens with him. And then who do you like on offense?
Actually, let me ask you a little bit about the pitchers down there. What do you think of Juan Noriega?
Noriega, I saw very, very briefly this spring. Junk baller. Didn't light up the radar gun, but he was throwing a bunch of different breaking balls. He's a tiny, tiny little dude. I think they list him at 5'7", which means he's probably about 3 feet tall. just a really small guy in the mound, but really interesting. He had a big year for the Dominican Dodgers last season. So, you know, kind of an aggressive assignment to full season ball straight from the DSL. And he's a guy who I thought they would develop as a starter, but given his very petite stature, you could possibly envision him in the bullpen. So I would say decent upside. You can give him a follow. Don't expect too much, but yeah, I want him to see the rotation to see what he can do as a starter.
Gotcha. And what about Brandon Martinez?
Martinez, I did not see this spring, and I've seen mixed scouting reports on him. It looks like a decent, you know, another decent follow. Big kid, can throw moderately hard, but, you know, really needs to get his command together, really needs to, you know, refine his secondary pitches. I think we'll hear more about him during the year. You know, he's an interesting prospect. Not really a, you know, I think he could work his way into being a mid-level prospect this year.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got some upside, but it's a little limited right now. So we'll see how he does over the season.
Yeah. I asked you about Martinez because he looks to be about one of the best starters the Loons have at this point in the season. So that should tell you a little bit about their pitching staff.
Yeah, you know, losing Lee Gould and Sanchez is just a killer for them. And they weren't getting any really high-profile guys. I mean, you know, you look at O'Sullivan, who was a pretty high draft pick last year. But other than that, yeah, Martin could be good. Matt Laney had a nice season in 2011, got off to a really rough start this year, walked four batters in five innings, allowed four hits, three runs. He's another guy I think I saw in spring training who was 87, 88, not overpowering. So, yeah, it's going to be tough for them if they don't have the pitching, because the Midwest League is just a pit for offense. There's so little offense there. It's so hard to hit there. You know, the Dodgers do have some decent prospects on that Loons club, but, they're going to be up against it. It's going to be a tough place for them to hit. You know, you look at their offense right now, one of their most exciting prospects, James Baldwin, injures his hand. Now he's out indefinitely. You look at Scott Schebler, who started the season 1-for-11 with 7 strikeouts.
Oof.
Yeah, just really tough. Noel Cuevas, 2-for-11. Joe Winker has had a little bit of success so far, 3-for-10. Pratt Maynard, 80 name, definite follow. He's gotten off to a decent start, although it's just 2 games for him. Jesus Alberto Arredondo is a guy I hadn't heard of, and all of a sudden he comes out in a game, one of the games of the doubleheader yesterday, and goes 3-for-3 with a double. So I really don't have any information about him, but he seems like a guy who might be an interesting follow.
Gotcha. Yeah, Maynard's probably of the guys you just mentioned, outside of Baldwin, Maynard's probably my favorite of the guys you mentioned. He was the Dodgers' third-round pick last year. Like you said, interesting follow. It's only a couple games so far. We'll see how he handles the Midwest League, because he didn't exactly light up the Pioneer League on his first assignment last season.
Yeah, the Dodgers' draft picks, their catchers especially, had a little bit of problems with the Pioneer League last year, which I found odd. I think only Chris O'Brien hit the ball fairly well. Maynard, he's definitely a dude I like. Has a good amount of potential. Not really a huge power guy, but he could be one of those solid, like, contact on-base doubles guys.
And maybe AJ Ellis version 2.0.
Possibly. I don't know if he has that much play discipline, because Ellis is, Ellis is an on-base addict. He needs a 12-step program to get off first base. But, Maynard, you could say that, because he's a pretty big guy, well put together, but he doesn't hit for a lot of power.
Right.
Definitely. And then I'm hoping that Baldwin comes back fairly soon. I'm actually going to have a few guys up in Great Lakes contributing to my website, LADugout.com, who are going to be going to the games with press passes, interviewing players, and hopefully they can get the word on what Baldwin's up to and when he's expected back.
Yeah, I tweeted the Loons play-by-play guy. He never got back to me. I tweeted James Baldwin himself, and he never got back to me. So it's anybody's guess on how serious the hand injury is right now.
Yeah, because, he started last season so well. He was doing incredibly through, I think, 11 July games, or June games, and then got suspended, came back, and just was never the same. And I saw him this spring. He can get real long in his swing, and he really, really, really needs to focus on being short to the ball, being quick. Don't worry about the power. He's a big guy, 6'3", probably about 180, 190. And, the power will come. When you're that big, you extend your arms, the power will come.
Yeah.
But he's a guy who really needs to focus on making contact. He's got exceptional speed. You know, he's a potential five-tool guy, but just really needs to focus on just playing the game the right way, making contact, getting on base, and not worrying so much about the homers.
Yeah, and the Loons are actually missing two guys who were projected to be there in Jock Peterson and Okoye Dixon. They're both out with injuries. As far as I know, Peterson's in extended spring training, rehabbing a groin injury, and Dixon has a hand injury that he suffered in the spring.
Okay, that explains it. Yeah, when I saw Peterson in spring training, he was actually playing. When I saw Dixon, he wasn't playing, or he wasn't hitting, but he was playing the field. So I'm assuming that the hand injury is probably to his right hand. Just, you know, my law deduction. That's a little Sherlock Holmes for you. So I think that, yeah, as soon as Peterson is healthy, as soon as Dixon's healthy, they're going to need a lot of help down there in Great Lakes, and those are two good hitters for them who can really compensate for the losses on the pitching staff.
Yeah, they can be their number three and number four hitters right there.
Absolutely. So that'll about do it for our opening day recap. And we would like to thank you for Dustin Nosler. I am Jared Massey. Thank you for listening to episode 2 of Dugout Blues. We will see you next time.